I'm honored tonight to introduce Mr. Coleman, and he will talk to us in great detail about many things, and of course he'll talk about justice. The unbalanced scales of justice are often out of perspective when police accusations are leveled against blacks. This is even more true if the persons involved are of sufficient stature to warrant public notice, either locally or nationally. A long line of police harassment and ugly misuse of police power has been the strong concern of tonight's lecturer since the middle 1960s. Mr. Coleman is a black man who was a high school dropout in one of Chicago's ghetto areas. Among other odd jobs prior to obtaining his high school credits, Mr. Coleman was a stevedore and a butcher. After having been awarded the U.S. Army Purple Heart, he entered the University of Chicago and earned a bachelor's degree in education and psychology. Mr. Coleman's legal education was received at John Marshall Law School in Chicago, from which he was graduated in 1965 as the highest ranking member of the senior class. Kermit Coleman has a full dossier of special involvements and activities as lecturer, advisor, lawyer, and civil rights proponent. Since 1968, he has been the director of Ghetto Project, the Roger Baldwin Foundation of the American Civil Liberties Union, Incorporated. Among his clients is Mr. Jesse Jackson, Bobby Rush, Mr. Reginald Robinson of the Afro-American Police League of Chicago, and many others. Without further delay, I'd like to give you Mr. Kermit Coleman.
Thank you very much, and all power to the people. Before I get started, I want you to know that I am not unmindful of the fact that it is presumptuous of me to stand here on a campus of a school whose trustees have refused the right of William Kunstler to stand here and talk to you. And because of that, I debated for a while as to whether or not I should come down. But since the specific interest of the topic that I had is one that doesn't get talked about too often, and I mean specifically the concept of justice and its misapplication as far as the black community is concerned, I say since it doesn't get talked about too much, I thought I wouldn't miss an opportunity to say something about it. David mentioned the Ghetto Project, and let me just briefly tell you what that is, solely that it will serve as perhaps the basis for some kind of credentials for whatever I have to say to you. Ghetto Project is simply a division, a part of the Chicago American Civil Liberties Union. My concern, and therefore my clients, are to the extent of about 95% black. The other 5% vacillates from time to time, sometimes the Spanish-speaking people, a couple of Indians once or twice. But still, people who are outside the mainstream of this nation's society. Within the context of working with people like that, and in an area like that of the criminal law, it becomes easy to see what is real as opposed to what is merely an illusion in the great American ethic. And probably nothing is so dramatic in the two faces, the one the illusion and the other the face of reality that's put out for consumption abroad, than the appearance that this country is one which accedes to a concept of justice for all its people. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. Maybe the difference could be described as the difference between the way it is and the way it's supposed to be, and the two seldom ever meet. Now, justice, as I'm going to use it now, means only justice as applied to the law, that is, a written body and a decided case body of rules which determine the conduct among people. And all people are expected, upon pain of some kind of punishment, to accede to those particular rules. One of the basic and fundamental places where we find those rules is in the United States Constitution. It's a body of literature which has been rightly praised for hundreds of years. It is, in fact, a good document. It is not the document which is at fault. It is the machinations and the hearts of people whose presence is necessary to put those documents into some kind of active relationship with the people of this country, and their failure to do so, which results in the lack of justice for a great many of the citizens of this country. The main parts of the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which I'd like to briefly mention and then pass on by, would be just the first, the fourth, fifth, sixth, and eighth amendments to the Constitution. And I'd like to see if I can describe what they are supposed to be, and yet what they really are when their force is felt, if in fact it is felt, in the black communities. Now, the First Amendment, you'll have to bear with me also because I'm just coming out of a very bad cold. But if you bear with me, I think I can make it. First Amendment, among other things, guarantees to the citizens of the United States the right of free speech. Free speech includes, and in fact was a concept which grew out of the need for and a recognition of the need for dissent from what may be popularly held ideas. I think it can be properly said that when a city or even a section of a city, let alone a nation, has its right to free speech seriously impaired, that nation, that city, that group of people is in serious, maybe unalterable trouble. How does the First Amendment and its adherence to the right of people to speak freely about what they think, to disseminate ideas, to talk about theories, to in fact communicate ideas one among the other, what happens to that concept in the black community? Let me tell you what happened to it in Chicago in 1967, at which time there were at least six very large mass arrests of black folk who got together for the purpose of doing just this, for discussing the problems that they were faced with at the time, for trying to seek a solution or some means of redress for those problems. What happened, of course, was that they were almost always, and certainly in these six instances, large numbers of black folk were arrested and charged with certain crimes as defined in the statutes of the state. Now, those crimes purport to be criminal sanctions. In fact, what they were being used for, you see, was for political purposes. It was being used to stifle dissent. The charges were being used to prevent black folk from talking about those problems that they had and for seeking that redress. Incidentally, you might just in your mind go over the numbers of black people that you've heard of in the last few years, and those who are dead, who've been killed one way or another, those who are currently inhabiting the penitentiaries of this country in one way or another, those who have had to flee from its borders in one way or another, and the actions of those people, very curiously, all are just talk. That's all they've done. They have attempted to communicate ideas, and for this they have found themselves in those various positions that I've just mentioned. I don't know of anybody who's in jail because he shot anybody. That's not true of Huey, but Huey didn't shoot anybody either, you see. In fact, those people are inhabiting jails and foreign countries and graves because they did what America said they could do, that is to say, they engaged in the right to free speech. Some of the other parts of the First Amendment are the right to the free expression of religion, of the press, the right to assembly and petition, and with just a casual, almost offhand reference to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam and the various trials and travails that they've had, I'll pass on now from the First Amendment to the Fourth. The Fourth Amendment, among other things, proscribes in law enforcement agencies of any kind from searching and seizing property belonging to the citizens of this nation. Now, very properly, what that means is that the police don't have a right to stop you and take something out of your pocket, whether that something be a weapon, whether it be a little bag of something to smoke, whether it happens to be whatever, a picture of your mother-in-law, if you will. You don't have a right to stop and take that out of your pocket. And yet, if I tell you that they do it, I don't think you'd be surprised, because it is routine police procedure in all areas that black people occupy. In the ghettos of Chicago, it is standard procedure. It is procedure which is accepted fully by the highest command of the police department. It's something that everybody knows goes on, and yet nobody ever tries to stop it. Again, the illusion of the Constitution of the United States saying that you can't search and seize a man's property without probable cause. On the other hand, it's done every day. The Fifth Amendment, among other things, says that you're supposed to have the right to due process. And due process means a lot of things, but what it means, among other things, and most importantly, probably is that if you are accused of a crime or an act which has some kind of sanctions which may be brought to bear on you, you have a right to be fully informed, and you have a right to see that all of the steps leading up to your charge and a possible finding of guilty and everything else is done strictly according to the rules of law. There can be no shortcuts. And yet, we find in the Circuit Court of Cook County, and incidentally, the Circuit Court of Cook County and its criminal division frequently looks as though Chicago is an all-black city. I think a rough guess at the proportion of black to white defendants in the criminal court would be something like 85 to 90% of those people would be black, and the rest would be white. I make no comment about it. I just tell you that that's the way it is. Those people have the right of due process encroached upon in many, many different ways. I won't even mention the policeman who tailors a particular story to serve a particular purpose when he makes an arrest, because he knows that if he tells the circumstances under the arrest in one manner, it'll result in an acquittal, and that if he tells it in another, it'll result in a conviction. And usually, of course, he feels, as a policeman, that his job is not simply to arrest someone he thinks has done something wrong, but to see that he's convicted, too. It's not a proper part of his job. The Sixth Amendment to the Constitution is one which guarantees a speedy trial, among other things, and an impartial jury of one's peers. I'd like to come back tomorrow and tell you about this, because it would take a day. But as far as a speedy trial, the word speedy in that context has been defined in different places at different times for different purposes. The only people who really get a speedy trial in Cook County, though, are those who have been arrested, locked in jail, and who are too poor to put up a ransom to allow themselves to be at liberty during the period of time that it would be most beneficial to them to be out there trying to put together a defense for the time when they're ultimately going to be called before the bar of justice and have to explain certain actions. And in order to do that, you need a lawyer, which costs money. You need to find witnesses to an incident, if there are witnesses, and you have to be out to do that. And you have to have a theory about what would be proper. In order to do any of this, it's necessary that you get with your counsel, that somebody, whoever it is going to represent you, has an opportunity to work on these things. A man who is precluded from having access to a lawyer, from having access to the facts of his case, because he does not have enough money to pay the kind of ransom that is called bail, is a man who's going to be tried in a hurry, and justice simply isn't going to be served. So the illusion here is that a speedy trial being a good thing, well, that's mellow because that's what he got, isn't it? Except that he got a speedy trial, which rushed him into the penitentiary more often than not. So it appears to be a compliance, at least with the speedy trial aspect, but it has grave connotations for those who are really innocent and don't have an opportunity to appear so. The other part of the Sixth Amendment is that dedicated to the proposition that a man, if he chooses to be tried by a jury, should be tried by a jury of people, as the saying goes, of his peers. And it isn't very difficult to understand. What it means is that if I or if any of you stand before somebody who has to make a judgment, which is going to determine whether you either live or die, or whether you're going to be locked up or allowed to go back and resume your life, it seems to me basic to that whole proposition that it means the jury who has to make that determination simply has to know something about me, has to know something about you, in fact, because to do otherwise is to expect a jury of 12 people, no matter how well-meaning they may be, to come into a setting to rule upon the actions of a person who is as foreign to them as though he came full-blown out of Mars somewhere. And that's the way it is, you see, with black folk and with white folk in this country. It's been said that black folk know more about white folk than white folk do about black folk, and that's probably true. But still in all, I don't think there are any white folk who would want an all-black jury. Now, no matter how much we know about you, you're entitled more than that. Problem arises, you see, in trying to get a black jury. Now, I don't mean, don't get uptight, I don't mean 12 black people. That would be asking too much. It would be fair, but that's so far from what's possible that I'd be satisfied sometimes to get a jury in which I'm defending some young black man or an old black man for that matter, and get just two black people who would be allowed to sit there and deliberate on the case. I saw a case being tried, a capital case, a murder case. A young man named Bobby Gore, who was president of a youth outfit in Chicago named the Conservative Vice Lords, and I sat and watched it. I was not involved in the case, and I usually don't watch other people's cases. But I was so struck by the physical appearance of this jury that was sitting, this jury of Bobby's peers. Bobby's 32 years old. He's black. He lives on the west side of Chicago. And until the liberal press and other liberal monies discovered him, he was poor as a church mouse. Now, with the interest in youth groups, he had just begun to make it. And he had begun to stretch out and to become politically active, very sharp. And for some reason or other, he was, at that stage of his development, cut down, charged with murder. And the jury, the median age of the jury had to be 60. And I sat and watched them as they, in that dotage, sat there and nodded. And they didn't have to listen to anything because they knew who Bobby Gore was. He was a black gang member. And our state's attorney, Mr. Hanrahan, has been at work telling everybody in Chicago what has to be done about gang members. Point is, of course, that he didn't stand a ghost of a chance. It appeared that he did. He got a jury trial, and all the rules of procedure were adhered to. He had competent counsel. The judge appeared to be fair, and for all I know was, I mean, no slap at the judge. He may have been completely fair. It was impossible for him to be acquitted because of the jury. This in spite of the fact the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution says he's entitled to an impartial jury of his peers, and these people were not peers of Bobby Gore, nor of mine. The Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, among other things, guarantees the right to bail which shall not be excessive. Another way of saying that, of course, is reasonable bail. I know the price of everything has gone up. But I remember reading in books and things and seeing old George Raft movies where Al Capone and Legs Diamond and Dutch Schultz and all those dudes who were in Chicago and in Cicero in the 1920s and just killing up a whole bunch of people. Still do it, as a matter of fact. The names are different. The outfit is the same. And yet, none of them ever had a bail as high as a young black cat in Chicago named Doug Andrews, who was accused of burning down the West Side, burning down Madison Street, if you will, in 1968. $100,000 ransom they wanted for Doug. Doug was politically active, too. He had, among other things, had put together a fairly effective community organization, which was beginning to make itself felt and to bring about some changes in the neighborhood where they lived. But $100,000. Went to the Supreme Court on that, because we thought we had a good case. Went to the Supreme Court and said, now that's ridiculous. And the Supreme Court of the United States said, that's right. And they lowered the bond to $75,000. And finally, the last amendment that I want to mention is, again, the eighth, and the last part of that. It just has to do with something called cruel and unusual punishment. And since I'm convinced that sometimes just being black in America is cruel and unusual punishment, I shall go past that. The next manner in which this illusion of justice makes itself felt is within the context of the laws which are passed both by the federal government, by these various state governments and municipal governments. That is, again, laws which are to govern the conduct of people. Now, the way the laws are subverted are many. I'll just mention a few of them. It's a concept called selective law enforcement. And if you don't listen carefully, that may sound like something that's pretty good. Anything that's selective shows that you're taking care, right? Yes. Except that selective law enforcement, as it is experienced in the black communities, and this is not just Chicago, incidentally, works like this. This group of people who were arrested in 1967 that I mentioned earlier, in each instance, every one, there was a total of some 343 altogether, every one was charged with a crime which is described as mob action. That's what the statute calls it. And it has, depending upon some elements being present, some fairly serious consequences if you're found guilty, one of which is going to the penitentiary, not to the jail, but to the penitentiary for as long as 5, and in some instances even 10 years, plus a fairly good-sized fine. So it's not a jab charge. It's, you know, it's really serious and should be taken seriously. All of those black people were charged with that. They were also charged with other things. Aha! A few months later, still in 1967, still in Cook County, and in fact still in the city of Chicago, Reverend King, who was there at the time, decided to lead a march of his followers into what had been fairly rabid racist territory on the southwest side of Chicago, a place called Marquette Park. And all he wanted to do was go and pray to the heathen, I suppose. He walked in any event, with some very peaceful people following him, and he just walked through these streets. And the response of the people was complete violence. People were set upon and beat. Rocks were thrown. Tire chains were used as weapons. The followers of Dr. King were scattered. Many of them hurt fairly seriously. Those in automobiles had cars turned over. Cars were set on fire. Gasoline thrown on them, matches. And something like 40 white people who lived in that area and who had been caught engaging in the kind of tactic that I've just told you were arrested. So far, so good. Looks like old justice is working pretty good. Except that those people were charged with disorderly conduct and nothing more. Did you hear me say that this first group engaged in any violence? I told you they were standing there talking about how bad things were. So black people, before they were charged with mob action, and the white people were charged with disorderly conduct. The bonds, incidentally, of which were $25 each. Without exception, $25. That ain't the way it's supposed to be, I don't think. Another way that the law is used to alter what should be is by the judicious use of certain charges which can be put together and in juxtaposition to each other and in certain configurations mean something that individually they don't mean at all. Do you know what I'm talking about? Well, policemen typically may stop a man in the ghetto and want to search him. Now, 15 years ago, he would just go ahead and search him. That'd be the end of it. That is not the way it is today, and there are a great number of young black people who would resent that kind of search and wouldn't hesitate to let the policeman know it, knowing, of course, that they're going to get into some kind of thing with the policeman still, because the principle is strong enough. They say, like, you know, why are you going to search me? You don't have a right to search me, or do you have a warrant, or some such question which puts the policeman on notice of two things. One is somebody who knows something about his rights. Secondly, that he's going to have to do more than just stick his hand in this man's pocket. What usually happens after that is that he does stick his hand in there, and then he usually hits a man upside the head, and then he arrests him, and now he has to bring him to court, because once he's hit somebody, something has to take place. He has to arrest him. What are you going to arrest him for? It isn't a crime like robbery or burglary or rape where you can go get a citizen who has committed a crime and say, Miss Jones, is this the man that grabbed you? Yeah, that's him. Or, you know, is that your wallet? Yes, he's the man that stuck me up or whatever it is, because, you see, the policeman himself is now, though he's acted as policeman, prosecutor, and executioner as well, he is at least also the one who claims the right to press the charge. But what charge will he press? Well, traditionally, it's done this way. The man is charged with resisting arrest. The resisting arrest, you see, accommodates the fact that he has been hit in the head. He may have a split over his eye, or he may be limping, or his clothing may be torn, whatever reasons. Resisting arrest means that the policeman has a right now to use some kind of authority, some force, in order to subdue him. Okay? Now, if he has hurt him badly, then the second charge is added, and that's usually an aggravated battery or an aggravated assault charge. This means that he was justified in using the degree of force he used in subduing the man. However, we are still left without a charge on which to base that original arrest for which he has been charged with resisting. And so up comes old disorderly conduct. Disorderly conduct is what a policeman thinks it is. It is whatever he wants it to be. And it is a charge that can be sustained by a lying pig and nothing else. Needs no other witnesses. He must have been arrested once or twice. In any event, this is another method whereby laws which have some legitimation taken apart and looked at from one perspective simply don't stand up when they are used for the purpose of repressing either individuals or a whole group of people, as I'm suggesting that they are now. I won't even bother mentioning stop and frisk. That wasn't new in a black community. That was just amusing to see the white communities begin to be concerned about a law being passed saying they could do what they'd been doing in the black community ever since I can remember. But now it's sanctioned, and I suppose I'd just as soon be put up against the wall and a hand stuck in my pocket if it's the law. At least maybe they're doing it somebody else. The concerns, it seems to me, of the laws, particularly those laws that are loosely called civil rights laws, and maybe the whole civil rights movement itself, used to very properly be things like the questions of open housing and equal opportunity and access to various public facilities. The issue now is no longer quite that high-blown. What it is now, I think, and is rapidly becoming, and David and I had a little discussion earlier, we don't quite agree as to where it's going, because he's more optimistic than I, but that's youth for you. the thing's coming down to a matter of life and death. I think it's extremely serious for the black community, and these kinds of excesses by a political system, and I don't mean either Democratic or Republican, because in this context they are indistinguishable from one another, but that is to say that they are the political powers. These kinds of excesses must be constantly viewed, and they must be constantly criticized, and no one must ever allow themselves to fall into the grave error of pretending that because today they are affecting only one group of people, that it's okay. You know, that it's kind of cool as long as they don't come in your back door, because, you see, it's axiomatic that frequently people who keep dogs and who keep them for the purpose of biting other people get bitten by those same dogs. It happens. And there's no question but that to allow the license to exist so that your authorities can use that kind of repression against one group of people invites them to use it against you in turn. Talked already about the question of bail. One of the effects, however, that ought to be mentioned with respect to this bail is that it has the effect of imprisonment before a finding of whether or not there's guilt. You see, the only reason for instance, for the setting of bail is to ensure that a man will come back to court when it is time for him to appear before the jail, before the court, or to see that if the kind of crime he's accused of, and indications are that he will go out and commit the same kind of crime again, or what I'm saying is that if he's a danger to the community. Now, if those two tests are met, then there simply is no reason at all to require that people put up money as ransom to make sure that they'll come back, particularly if they show you that they were born in a city, they have husbands and wives and children and family there. They have jobs which they'll lose, incidentally, by being locked up. But these considerations are for nothing, and in Cook County, it is the rule rather than the exception that unless you can make the ransom with the money, you simply don't get out. And this despite the fact that, again, within the statutes of the state of Illinois, there's very, very proper laws which allow a court to send you home without putting up any money, only upon a showing that you'll probably be back. And most people do come back. They never use this section. It's called a recognizance bond or an individual bond. It's hardly ever used. Another law just in passing, that an interesting one that the state of Illinois has, and I don't know if any other place has it, but there's a law which passed the state legislature enabling the creation of a mobile voter registration unit. Now, this is so that people who can't get out, you know, those old farmers who can't get away because of the crops and things, and they can't get down to register. Well, this makes it very nice because the truck will go up to the farm and knock on the door and say, "Farmer Jones here? Yeah, you didn't register. You want to register?" "Yeah, I'd like to register." You know, and he does his thing there. Interesting thing is that in Chicago, where the overwhelming bulk of numbers of black people in this state live, was specifically exempted and accepted from this law. Can you dig it? In Chicago, there is no mobile voter registration, and there isn't even a lot of noise made when it's time to register. So that if you haven't registered and you want to know when and where, you better keep your ears open, because there's nobody going to be yelling at you where it is. Strange. Now, how about the people who work at making the system go? I'm talking about the judicial system. They would be people like police, and it takes lawyers, it takes judges, it takes a jury. And the police probably should be first because they're the first ones you see. That's where you get busted. The police, which has been quite properly, adequately, and precisely defined as the main bastion of institutionalized racism in this country, is the very body to whom is entrusted the conduct between and among black folk in their communities, if you will. It has been proper and very, very popular lately within the last few years to regard the police department of large urban cities as being really a kind of control arm, a colonialist power, which is there for the purpose of keeping down the people rather than seeing that the laws as they are written are enforced. For instance, you can write policy all you want to on the south side of Chicago and on the west side too, because that ain't a big thing at all. You can book horses, you can sell a little reefer, you can sell a little skag, you can almost anything you want to, until your actions move you to the gates of political activity, until in fact you do anything which is relevant to the bettering of the condition of yourself and your people if you happen to be black. At that point, all rules give way and you get busted. The police, despite the fact that in Chicago at least they drive around in blue and white cars that say on the side, "We serve and protect," they don't mean that at all. They don't really mean that at all. They may serve and protect those middle-class white neighborhoods where that's what they better do. But they don't mean that when they go into the black community. They go into there, into the black community for something else. I'm just amazed myself at the use of the American flag these days and how these pigs have all stuck these little decals on the cars that they drive. You know, it's my car because I help pay the taxes and I don't want an American car, American flag on my police car. You know? And yet, if I were to try to take it off, I don't have to tell you what would happen to me. In Chicago, there is an organization, and not just Chicago, there are other large cities that have begun to be organizations now of policemen who say, "We are dedicated to the propositions that you say," speaking to the police department, "that you say you are but aren't." Now, these groups call themselves by lots of different names, and they are uniformly black, and the one in Chicago calls itself the Afro-American Patrolman's League. And it was started by two men who are good friends of mine as well as clients of mine, Buzz Palmer and Reggie Robinson, both of whom were on the police force at the time. Buzz is now writing a book about his experiences once he made the announcement that he was going to act like a policeman should. And as soon as Reggie gets out of trouble, he's going to write a book about it, if he ever does. But the picture of police officers who say, "This is the way police are supposed to act," and then begin to comport themselves with dignity and with a kind of professionalism. Excuse me, I don't know what that means, but everybody uses it. But the kind of professionalism that everybody says they'd like to see in their police departments, and then who get hassled about it and get thrown off the force and get all kinds of dirty details is just too much to understand. Let me tell you another little incident about a couple of policemen who thought that when you took the oath to protect and serve the people of your community, that it meant that. This is not all the way up in Chicago. This is not far from here in Kankakee, Illinois, which is another nice little town. They got three black policemen there, three full-time, one part-time. I don't know what a part-time policeman does, but they got one. Anyway, one of these three full-time policemen is a lieutenant. Can you dig that, first of all? He is a policeman who is in charge of the human relations department. You know what I mean? When you got a complaint, you call him, and he holds your hand. The other two are patrolmen. Now, in Kankakee, there's a traditional rivalry of two high schools for a basketball game. Sounds like the script to an old bad Andy Hardy movie, but it's true, every word of it, I swear it is. And there was a big thing between the black students and the white students a couple of days before this game, and the police came down and arrested 60 black kids and sent all the white kids home and say, "Stay out of trouble." You know, so it didn't go down so well. So people went to the superintendent of the Board of Education and to the principal of the schools and said, "Call this game off because it's really going to be bad. You know, we can anticipate some trouble and we can try to avoid it." But they said, "No, you know, we run the school system." So they had the game. And sure enough, there was a big thing afterward, you know, kids fighting each other. During the context of that fight, one policeman, a white policeman, caught a black kid and began striking him about the head, as they say in their reports. Striking him about the head and shoulders with his stick, you know. And it threw him up on the top of the car and began to hit him again across his legs and scrotum and things like that. You know. So these two black cops saw that and walked over, and one of them said, "Hey, don't do that, you know." I said, "Just don't do that. You know, you want to get him in the car, I'll put him in the car. Just don't hit him like that." And began to engage him in conversation about the propriety of policemen using physical force in arresting a juvenile prior to a determination that he'd done anything seriously wrong. While they were discussing this back and forth, the kid split, which was okay, but for our case it was kind of bad. But the upshot of that was, if you can imagine, that the black policemen were then served with charges. They were charged with interfering with the police and also with refusing to come to the aid of this brother officer. Now, that's no joke, and I didn't make it up, and I'm going to have to defend those two people April 1st. But to, you know, the mind boggles at the insane society that would make a lawyer use his time to get involved in something as silly as that, and that a whole community could divide itself on an issue of who's right, when there just simply is no question about right or wrong. There's no question about black and white. It's just a matter of proper and improper police work. It just happened that the black police were doing the right thing there. But there's no question but that Kankakee is uptight about it. I don't know what the result would be, because the people who are going to have to hear that case, they come out of Kankakee too. Well, let me talk about lawyers for a minute. Now, I'm not talking about, when I say lawyers, that's a very, very loose and general term. And everybody that's an attorney ain't a lawyer. But I don't mean, for instance, the LaSalle Street lawyers of Chicago or the Wall Street lawyers of New York or whatever street it is here in Champaign. I don't mean those people. I'm talking about, you know, lawyers who get involved in criminal work, you know, which is kind of dirty, and cats really don't want to get involved in that. And if you want to make money, you don't get involved in it either. But they can be grouped in two categories. There are prosecutors and there are defense attorneys. Now, some prosecutors later turn out to be defense attorneys. I used to be a prosecutor. Now, the prosecutor has a responsibility and a duty, for instance, every state's attorney of every county in the state of Illinois, and that includes Larry Johnson down here, every one of them has a responsibility to make sure that when he arrests any person and he has any information which leads him to believe that either the charge shouldn't be brought against the person or there is evidence which ought to be brought out that isn't, that may be in favor of a defendant, he has a duty to bring that to the attention of the court. And in all honesty, after prosecuting for 2 years, I never once saw a prosecutor who did that in Cook County. They'll hide it, you know, because the thing comes down to winning the case, and therefore reputations are made on winning a case. And a cat's a good lawyer if he wins his cases, so that they have subverted the whole. What used to be, I don't know, long before my time, I suppose there was a fairly high moral tone to the practice of law. At least I've read about people that I dig who used to practice law. There are not many of them anymore. There are a few. But they don't end up as prosecutors. Like Mr. Foran, waiting until the conspiracy trial was over. And after the trial, he says in a public interview that in fact what had happened on the streets of Chicago in August of 68 was really, as he saw it standing there, frequently turned into a police riot. He denied that all the way through the trial. He consistently hammered away at any testimony tending to show that that was the case. The trial's over and he's won his case. And now he says, "Oh yes, as a matter of fact, that was the case." How can you believe Tom Foran? Well, maybe it isn't important. Another thing is the responsibility to bring charges is also on the prosecutor, So they can charge you with whatever they want to. Now, they've got to prove whatever they charge you with. Maybe. For instance, it used to be that in shootings between the police and citizens, if nobody hit anybody else, then they were charged, the defendants, if they were caught, they were charged with aggravated assault. See, what they've done properly, and that's a proper charge, it is reasonably putting a police officer in apprehension of his safety, which is pretty accurate. You know, cat shooting at you, I suppose you reasonably can feel apprehensive. Except that that's not a very serious charge. It's just a little old jive charge. But attempted murder, wow, that, you know, that's heavy. It just sounds heavy. So ever since December of 1968, which is when the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party was created, well, it was really created in November, but the first bust was in December. But ever since then, any youngsters who are thought to be members of the Black Panther Party and who are alleged to have shot at policemen under any circumstances at all are charged with attempted murder. I even had a case where a boy threw what was a fairly heavy mug, but a mug nevertheless at a policeman, and he too was charged with attempted murder. The reason for that, of course, is not only that if you start the charge high, then when you reduce it, you can only reduce it so low, but it allows for a larger bail to be set. And therefore, the larger the bail, the more likelihood there is that the defendant won't get out. And that, again, from the standpoint of the prosecution, is a good thing. Another thing that happens is a thing that happened with your own state's attorney down here, Larry Johnson. Bobby Rush was tried down here on a charge of, it was a gun charge, and was found guilty. And we're appealing the case. Now, the appellate court, which is hearing that case, is located in Springfield. My office is in Chicago, quite a little distance. In addition to which, in order to go down to Springfield for one day, that blows a whole day for me. I can't, you know, if I stay in Chicago, I can handle four or five things in a day. If I go down there, that's all, you know, and maybe even stay overnight. So Bobby, when he got ready to make some money for the party, which is in the way that they do it, with the exception of selling the Black Panther newspaper, the only other method for bringing in any decent amount of money is speaking engagements. So they go out and speak to anybody who'll pay a little something, tell them what the Black Panther Party is about. And in order to do that, the chairman of the party would be most in demand, obviously. And after Fred died, it meant that after Fred was murdered, it meant that Bobby had to fulfill this function. In order to do it properly, he had to pass over the limits of Illinois. So I've never had any problem getting somebody permission to travel when they're out on bond. I asked for the same permission for the appellate court located at Springfield. And Larry Johnson, the great liberal from Champaign, he got a special assistant state's attorney, you know, to do nothing but answer my arguments. Well, that's not really fair, see, because I was up there and he was down here. He was closer, first of all. Besides which, he was using prejudicial arguments. He was using untruths, and he was speculating about what Bobby was going to be doing when he was traveling, where all I could do was tell the truth, that he was going to raise some money by speaking engagements, speaking at colleges and at civic gatherings, things like that. He successfully thwarted us at any number of attempts to try to get the allowance for Bobby to travel. Finally, the last time, the Supreme Court, the appellate court said, okay, you can go. And then in its order, its last sentence said something like, but it shall be the responsibility of Kermit Coleman to give information to the Champaign County State's Attorney or the Illinois Attorney General about where Bobby Rush is whenever they ask, okay? I get this back in the mail like on a Tuesday, and I'm reading it Tuesday afternoon, and the phone rings, and guess who it is? Larry Johnson wants to know where Bobby Rush is. I can't believe that there isn't enough crime occurring here in Champaign City and in Champaign County to keep a man and his staff occupied a man who is concerned about an individual who, as far as I know, doesn't intend to come down here anymore. Because he is bright. And I can't imagine the interest, unless it is a political function that he finds himself serving. He is not serving the people of Champaign County, who are not in any danger from Bobby Rush. You know, I promise you that. You know. And yet Larry Johnson seems to concern himself with the prospect that you are. Too bad. Defense lawyers. Now, really not much to be said about defense lawyers, except a particular type of defense lawyer. Defense lawyers, criminal defense lawyers generally, learn pretty quickly what you can and what you can't get away with. And you begin to specialize so that a man who represents policy runners and policy wheels pretty soon has a staff of policemen, vice cops, on his payroll. Now, he can really function very well and serve the interests of his clients well because some of the police are in his employ. Money gets through to the judge who hears the case, and there's plenty of money to go around. It's gambling money, and nobody is really hurt, and the charade goes on. So every day you just stand up in front and argue your case, take your people home. Same is true of those who have other kinds of specialties within the criminal law. Where it does not apply, where even that sub rosa function of the defense lawyer falls down, is those lawyers who represent what I suppose can best be called unpopular causes. Unpopular with people who have authority. Unpopular with the system, the establishment, with whatever you want to call it. But unpopular with those people who run the legal system. One sad thing that has begun to happen since the conspiracy trial is that Mr. Hoffman, incidentally, you should know, if you don't, that Judge Hoffman didn't act any differently during the course of the conspiracy trial than he always acts. He's always that way. It is just that for the first time he got a public showing that that's the way he was. But the man has been an insane man for years. In any event, since that time, it seems that the official and authoritative forces of the courts have been used more and more against lawyers who handle these kinds of cases. I can give you some names immediately. They won't mean anything to you, but I'm going to mention them because they are important to me. There's a man named Len Carlin, a lawyer in Chicago, good old-time liberal civil rights lawyer who has been arrested for assaulting a cop. The cop's name was John Manley, incidentally. And he's known, his claim to fame is that he's busted more homosexuals than anybody else in the city. Can you dig a cat named Manley doing that? Anyway, so Len Carlin is arrested in the courtroom. You know, something never happened before. You don't arrest lawyers. You know, you're supposed to keep your hands off of them. But they don't do that anymore. And another man, Frank Oliver, who had the temerity to suggest that the precautions being used at the federal building during the course of the conspiracy trial tended to make people coming in and out, that is to say, the precautions, you open your briefcase, open your coat, pat you down when they had a bomb scare, and that this tended to make prospective jurors of a kind of slanted mind when they got ready to hear cases and would prevent people from getting fair trials. He was cited for contempt of court, and they tried to take his license away from him. They have not so far been successful in doing that. Ann Langford, another old-time black woman lawyer, who is an old-time civil rights lawyer and who has before been held in contempt of court, but never in the manner that she is now in contempt of court. I myself have just finished being tried on 3 separate charges of contempt of court, as well as having been thrown bodily out of a coroner's inquest. Never had that happen before. They threw me out of a coroner's inquest because I was trying to get to the proof of the matter. I guess I got carried away and thought I was playing a Perry Mason and forgot where I was. But it seems to me that any lawyer, any black or white lawyer, who professes to believe in any kind of system of justice and who is not contemptuous of the state that the courts are in today, simply is not worth calling himself a lawyer. I think it's a marker. You should take pride in being contemptuous of
of as vile a situation as we're confronted with every day. Then we have judges. Judges are an integral part of this, too. Where do the judges come from? Why? The people elect them, right? That's what you think. They are elected. But how are they chosen? There's been, if you remember, they used to talk about other countries, I think Russia and some other communist countries, and how the elections were free elections, but you only had one choice. You know, you could either choose to vote or not vote, and that was all you had. Well, that comes very close to being the method by which judges are put on the bench in Cook County, and I don't know if it's any different here. I suspect it's the same. You get a political hack who comes out of law school, and he becomes a precinct captain and gives fealty and obeisance to a political party, and he does the things he has to do, and finally gets the right to run for office, and finally gets put on the bench. And that may be all right if, in fact, all he's ever going to be required to determine is whether you are actually going 35 miles an hour in 30 mile zone. I would have not too much argument with that. The intellectual capacity needed to make such decisions is not great, and the intellectual capacity brought to the bench by these men also is not great, and maybe that's the way it should be. But to take men like this and put them in black robes and let them determine the future of people who are engaged in dissent from the society in which these people get their bread and butter, to make a political hack responsible for the dispensing of justice to somebody who is a non-believer in the concept of justice is a travesty. It's just too much. But it's done. There's a plaque over the Chief Justice of the Municipal Court of Cook County. Over his door, I don't remember exactly what it says, but it says something like, the Municipal Courts of Cook County, that's the little court, is for the right of the little people, for poor people, I'm sorry. You know, nothing could be farther from the truth. It simply isn't true at all. They are the very people who are the victims of that society, and who, by an kind of inverse reasoning on behalf of these people, are made to appear the villains. Malcolm said it, and it was true when he said it. It was true before he said it. It's true now, and it'll be true tomorrow, that one of the ways that a repressive system of government or a repressive system of anything gets its way is to convince people that the real victims are, in fact, villains. So there you have people like Rap Brown looking like, you know, the scourge of the Antilles, you know, really bad dude, right? You know, except that simply isn't so. The crimes with which he's charged are not those kinds of crimes. None of them. All of the crimes with which young black people involved in activist activity today, none of those crimes even approaches in horror this one poor old sick man who on the south side of Chicago made a bomb for God knows what reason except that he was an old Marine and stuck it in a department store and killed two or three strangers to him for no reason other than that his mind was ill. That's not the same thing at all. Let me tell you about the courts of the state of Illinois. Among my clients, I number the Black United Front of Cairo, Illinois. Those were people who were basically poor people and had a grievance, and they wanted to redress their grievance in the manner laid down by law and also by tradition in this country. If you have that's not completely true, because when George III had his way in this country, that's not exactly the way the founding fathers set about to correct that situation. These people didn't go back that far. They believed in peaceful dissent, and so in order to try to get some accommodation, some redress for their grievances, they went to Springfield, Illinois, and there they went to the office of the governor of Illinois, Mr. Ogilvie. Mr. Ogilvie has often proclaimed his stand for law and order and the fact that he is in favor of it, as is, I suppose, every current politician in one fashion or another. For their pains, they got arrested, and they were charged with some fairly inconsequential crimes, but crimes nevertheless. Those crimes were not coming on to trial until last month. They were set, I believe, for the 17th of February. And I had been asked if I would represent them, told Charles Cohen that I would do it, and explained to him that I would come down on the 17th to Springfield. I'd come in and get the cases continued over into April, because they'd never asked for a continuance, and this happened back in July of 1969. But get a continuance over to April, because it would take about 2 or 3 weeks to try the case, and then come back on that date. I had never seen the defendants, I had talked to none of them, and I know only sketchily what the issue was. I'd never seen the bill of information against them. I knew less about that case than probably some of you do right now. I go ahead and explain this to the judge, who says, no, you've got to go trial today. I said, Judge, I can't go to trial today. And I explained to him why, that I had commitments for the next day in court and for the next 3 weeks, solidly, that I had to be in court every day, that I couldn't stay down there. And he said, well, he could understand that. He understand how it is. But there wasn't anything he could do about it. The best he could do is just release me from the case. Of course, that wasn't no big thing either, because I hadn't filed an appearance. So he wasn't doing me any favors. So I got out of the case, which meant that these people who were so poor that they couldn't hire a lawyer, which is why they asked me anyway. See, if they'd had some money, they could have hired somebody down in Springfield. These same poor people who went to Springfield for their redress of their grievance then found themselves put in the position of having to try their own case. And that's almost a sure way to lose. Yeah. And they did lose. And now they're faced with an appeal. So the circle of justice was extremely telling as far as I was concerned. You know, poor people, redress, get busted. And again, because of their poverty, they can't get a lawyer. Finally get a lawyer who worked for nothing. And then the man said, but you can't have him, you know, because unless he's ready to go to work today, then you try the case yourself. Justice. Justice by Governor Ogilvie, the man who runs this city, this country. Let me tell you something else about Governor Ogilvie. I just have to mention it because I'm kind of pissed off at Governor Ogilvie. That's why. In Chicago on the west side, there is a 6th congressional district which was occupied by a white congressman whose name was Daniel Ronan. Mr. Ronan died about 17 months ago, which left a vacancy. That had been, at the time Dan Ronan was elected, a changing community. You know what that means? It was a changing community. Almost simultaneously, in the silk stocking district of Evanston, Illinois, where very few poor folks live, the 13th congressional district, Donald Rumsfeld resigned his post as congressman to go take a job with Mr. Nixon. So left two congressional districts which had to have representatives replaced. Within 48 hours of the resignation of Rumsfeld, Mr. Ogilvie called a special election, which was duly had in time, and Mr. Crane was elected congressman. That was about 17 months ago. People in the 6th district, now that's that black district out there, a few whites still there, they wrote a letter to Mr. Ogilvie and said, hey, how about having an election over here, because we don't have no congressman. And there's a lot of legislation in Congress right now that really affects us. You know, they're talking about arresting people and detaining them prior to, detaining them prior to arresting them, and they're talking about things like making you go through the changes of having your picture taken, fingerprints and all that, without being arrested, and those things concern us, plus a lot of other issues, you know. And we need somebody to represent us, because after all, that's what the Boston Tea Party was all about. And Mr. Ogilvie didn't respond to that. For some 12 months, he didn't respond to that. They were constantly urging upon the governor to call issue his writ of election, to call this election. He didn't do it. So we filed a suit against Mr. Ogilvie, and the force of the suit was to compel him to issue his writ of election and to have a proper election in the 6th congressional district. Now, that may not have been a completely black and white problem. Mr. Ogilvie is a Republican, and all black communities are Democratic, and so there was also that problem, too. Nevertheless, law and order would have determined, I think, that Mr. Ogilvie act within the law and call that thing, which he was required to do. He didn't. We filed suit last part of November 1968. in the federal court. And the suit allowed the state government 30 days within which to respond to that suit and say, you know, here's our answer to the charges being made. We waited 30 days and we found out that's 30 days not from the time we file, but 30 days from the time the U.S. Marshal takes our paper and serves it on the governor. Okay, you dig it? You know, you have to do that, see? He has to be notified. That's the law. You can't file a suit. You got to notify a man. So the time begins to run from the time he's notified. Well, after all, it's the governor of Illinois. He's not underground, exactly. So after our 30 days pass, we go back over to the federal building thinking we'll get a default judgment, and we find out that the marshal hasn't served the papers yet. I said, well, why haven't you served the papers? Well, they've been very busy. You know, they've been doing a whole lot of things, like searching people when they came into the building during the conspiracy trial. So we pitch a fair bitch. Finally, get the marshal. We just, you know, really almost laid down on the ground and kicked the floor and say, you know, don't know what we're going to do if you don't do that. I don't know what we would have done. But finally, they served the papers on the governor. So now we know. Then they call and said, okay, everything's cool. Your papers have been filed. So now we wait for the 30 days, and then we find out there's no answer at the end of that 30 days. So we call the governor's office. They don't know anything about the suit. Well, after investigation, they find out that what had happened was the papers had been delivered to somebody in the office, and she, seeing election written on there, had filed them in some place called election papers. Yeah. Here's a monumental suit in the federal court while we're trying to get some justice. You know, and these people are acting like we're out of our minds. Then the federal judge to whom it was assigned, Judge Robson, throws us out of court twice. You know, for saying that we really had no reason for asking this. Finally, after they had wasted all this time, the argument was, well, hell, it's almost time for a real election anyway. So, you know, what are you talking about? Why not just wait for the election? The point was, of course, that that's what they had in mind in the beginning. They were dilatory tactics, and they were using the power of the federal government and to assist the state government in refusing to carry out a mandate of the people. And that ain't no power of the people. If the people can't enforce its elected representatives to do those things that it is caused by law to do, as well as those things that it wants it to do, then the people have no power. And when the power has been taken away from the people, what has resulted, and the only thing that left there is some kind of tyranny, various kinds, but some kind of tyranny right here in the state of Illinois now. Anyway, that's the kind of thing that happened. Just briefly about the juries, which are important too. They are usually neither impartial nor are they peers of black folk. The South used to have a better way of doing this. They were just honest. They said, you know, niggas ain't gonna vote. And as long as they don't vote, they ain't gonna be on no juries down here. And everybody knew that that was the case. And so you had no anticipations, no expectations of a beneficent force at work on your behalf to give you something called justice. Black people in the South understood that. Black people in the North didn't, because it wasn't so well understood. There were subtle undercuttings. They said, yes, you can get a black jury here, you know, because you're entitled to it by right of law. And then immediately went back to the office to begin to figure out how to prevent you from doing that. In the 2 years that I prosecuted in the criminal court, I can honestly say that in the city where the black population is roughly variously, because nobody knows for real, and they won't know after the census this year either, so nobody will tell you no different. But where the estimate varies from 40 to 50% black, I never saw more than 5% prospective jurors who were black. And they don't ever make it through. I've never seen any young black women or young black men on a criminal jury in Cook County. The only ones that they will ever let serve have to come with their own bandana or have all at least the accoutrements and the earmarkings of somebody that they're used to dealing with. This is done, you see, by allowing the state, the prosecution, to do something that the defense is allowed, and that's called a peremptory challenge of a juror. Sounds fair. If the defense gets a chance to do it, then the state should have a right too, because that's fair, you know, injustice. No, it's not. Because the defense should have a right to choose just by looking at a man. You know, you, in questioning, a skillful lawyer may scratch something and pus may run out, and it may not be enough to really nail him as a racist and one who is completely unsympathetic to a cause in your mind. And yet you have some very bad vibrations, and you say, I just don't want him on that jury. And you excuse him politely, but there's no reason, there's no cogent reason for allowing the prosecution to do that. As a matter of fact, to allow the prosecution to do it means that the prosecution is taking an unfair advantage, because you are supposed, after all, to assume that a man or a woman is innocent until guilt is proven. So that's another little Sunday afternoon crisscross that they engage in. The wardens also take part in this. They are the pig pen keepers. They are the ones who, on the one hand, talk to the John Howard Society about the need for more recreational facilities for the rehabilitation and reclamation of this human waste that's come to their doors, and on the other hand, treat the inmates like animals, or worse than animals sometimes. I have in my own acquaintance a warden who is fond of going down among the tiers from time to time with a can of mace and seeing what he can stir up. I suppose he gets his little vicarious cookies out that way, but it is sad. Almost finally, there's the concept of post-trial remedies in the administration of justice. Now, what that means is that you can rest assured that even if you get ripped off at the trial court level, you still have behind you the majesty of the appellate courts, those courts of appeal, to whom you can go and let them look at your case again. This is supposed to be the salvation for the conspiracy, if you think about it. Problem is that that avenue is open only to people who have considerable money or who happen to be able to interest a lawyer in their case. For most people, for most poor people, and for 95% of black people who get convicted of crimes, that little magistrate's court or that circuit court, whatever it is, that trial court is the court of last resort. And if you don't get it there, you don't get it at all, and you're just going to have to go to the joint and do your time, despite all of the high-sounding words that are used to describe our appellate system. Three questions occurred to me as I was trying to determine what it was I was going to talk to you about. And the first question was, should blacks become involved in the practice of law today? And I answered these questions for myself only, just as a kind of exercise. And my answer to that one is, I don't know. And the second question was, is law or the practice of law irrelevant to black people today? And my answer to that is, I think so. And then the natural question which has to come out of that, if that's so, what am I doing here? And the answer to that is, maybe only because from the time I get up in the morning, I've got to do something until it's time to go to bed. The thing is, I don't have to fool myself about it, though. And I would say to you brothers and sisters who are sitting out there, please don't fool yourselves about it either. Thank you very much. If you got any questions, I'll answer.
Good afternoon. This is Open End, WYLL's weekly series of half-hour programs on topics of current interest. Today, a conversation with Kermit Coleman, attorney, director of the Illinois Ghetto Project with headquarters in Chicago, and a staff member of the Roger Baldwin Foundation of the American Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Coleman spoke on the University of Illinois Urbana campus on Tuesday evening, March 17th. The following morning, he joined us in our studios for the following conversation. Heard in conversation with Mr. Coleman were Miss Doris Whalum and Mr. David Addison, both students in the College of Law on the Urbana campus. Now, a conversation with Kermit Coleman.
Exactly what is Ghetto Project, Mr. Coleman?
Well, it's a kind of nebulous term to cover a need that the American Civil Liberties Union in Chicago recognized a couple of years ago. They had, of course, always been involved in the fight for civil liberties and for all people, but they realized at some time that the needs and the problems and the priorities that were facing the black community were a little different than most and probably deserved some kind of special treatment with a special focus. And in line with that, they looked around to hire a black lawyer, found me, hired me. And what the project has become in the ensuing 2 years is a kind of ombudsman law office in its relationship to the black community, people who feel black people primarily, although once in a while we get others, but generally black people who feel that their civil liberties have been violated in some way or another, come and make complaints, and we either defend them, bring suits, or intervene and do, in fact, whatever we can.
We have a high arrest potential on this campus, and I imagine this is true in most black communities. And most of the charges that most of the people are charged with are disorderly conduct, along with whatever else they're charged with, and also resisting arrest, and also interfering with a police officer. And I understand from your talk last night that this is a pattern in Chicago also. And I'd like to know whether or not you see any pattern in this, whether or not it's a policy that's been instituted by the department.
I don't think there's any question about it. But it isn't a new policy, and it isn't a new phenomenon either. Traditionally and historically, I'm sure you probably know that in the labor movement and in other movements of dissent in the history of America, the local police have tended to regard activities on behalf of people who are dissenting as criminal activities and have used that particular charge, disorderly conduct, in an attempt to curtail the First Amendment activity, that is to say, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, the right to petition. The Supreme Court has over and over again said that you can't do that, that you cannot use political persuasion, persuasion not being, of course, a proper word, something a little stronger than that, but you can't use political power to deprive a citizen of his First Amendment rights. The only thing is that, as the Supreme Court has said it, frequently local law enforcement agencies have not been listening. As a result, they continue to do this. The interesting thing that happened in 1967 in Chicago, they had used an ordinance, city ordinance of disorderly conduct, so often for this purpose, which we thought was an unlawful purpose, that we filed a suit to have that particular ordinance declared unconstitutional. Went up, and the federal courts did, in fact, declare the ordinance unconstitutional. Well, as lots of things in Chicago do happen, one of the things that happened there was what we had and what we thought was a victory turned out to be a Pyrrhic victory, because the city council just met and enacted another ordinance along generally the same lines, avoiding the language which had been objected to before, and increasing the penalty from $200 to $500. So what had seemed like a victory turned out to be a matter of standing there with broken eggs in our hands. So I suppose the answer to your question is yes, it's still being used, and in a monolithic, politically dominated area like Chicago, I don't know, frankly, what you can do about it. There's only so much money to continue bringing lawsuits. And if the administration of the city can just turn around and vitiate whatever effect the victory of winning a suit may be, well, I don't know that that's the proper way, or at least an effective way, to remedy the situation.
Wouldn't you call that a dilemma of a sort that constantly and repetitively the higher court in the state or in, you know, the United States will hold something unconstitutional, will make a ruling, and as you said, the police departments fairly ignore it, and you find yourself in court, say in a given period of 4 or 5 months, you know, defending, while the fact situation differing a little bit, but actually defending the same principle over and over again. It's sort of like a thing that the police do not take notice, I don't want to use the term judicial notice, of what has been passed. And does it make your job more frustrating in a sense, or do you just, you know, feel this is really your job, even though, you know, it's a repetitive thing? And as you say, you know, the broken eggshell theory, you've got another one right before you, and probably you'll take going to court on that, depending on how much it's used. Do you find that very, you know, frustrating at all as a lawyer?
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating, and I think that the only way you could just continue to do it and say, well, you know, that's the way it is, and continue to act in the same fashion, is to have those broken eggs in your head. Otherwise, you're simply not going to do it, because if solutions are not viable, they're not solutions at all. And they have the appearance of being solutions, but they're not. What happens is that not only the police, because there is some excuse for the police pretending they don't know the law. Apologists for police action are always saying, well, aggressive police work is what we want. And of course, that is what the little old ladies in tennis shoes want. You know, they really want to be protected from the masses of black and hippie and, you know, all those bad people out there who are liable to do them harm. But so the police really get aggressive, and they'll bust somebody knowing full well that they can't make it stand up in court. That I think I could live with. It's a very bad practice, but I could manage to live with it. What really distresses me is for a case like that to finally get to court and find that there's somebody who's been invested with the right to sit behind a bench, put on a black robe, and make a decision about the case, who joins the police, who gets in league with them, knowing that he's making bad law, that he's ruling erroneously. But because he's a member of a team, a member of this team, who sees that his responsibility to the public is to act despite the fact that he knows that his actions are in contravention of the law, and says quietly, well, if I'm wrong, you can appeal it. Of course, which is complete nonsense, you know, because everybody can't appeal. That, I think, is really reprehensible behavior, and we got a lot of that in Chicago. There are some judges who sit there who one wonders sometimes if they have ever read an advance sheet to learn what current law is. That I can't tolerate.
There is another question. It's more national in scope, but I wish you would comment on it. It concerns the lack of uniformity in laws, and I'm speaking specifically in reference to the Manson case in correlation with Bobby Seale's recent trial until he was severed, Conspiracy 7, when his attorney, who was ill, could not file an appearance and he was forced to go to trial, and then he asked to defend himself and was denied. He was denied that privilege. And
Right, if you please.
Okay, that right. And Manson, who actually has been, you know, involved in, I don't know, multi-killings on that one transaction, was granted, you know, the
You've
right.
You've already found Mr. Manson guilty, I hope not.
Well, I'm saying who is alleged to, I say that in reference to a speech, which I would consider less serious in nature than the allegations of a murder trial. Nevertheless, Manson, for one reason or another, was denied, was granted the right to defend himself and was given counsel to assist him at the beginning. I understand it's been revoked. But Bobby Seale was never afforded this. Would you comment upon that? And if so, could you possibly distinguish? And
I don't think there's any distinguishing needed. I think what it is a matter that I don't know who the judge was in California who ruled first that he could, Manson could defend himself, and then subsequently withdrew it. I read in the newspapers that it was withdrawn because his erratic or allegedly erratic actions indicated to the court that he wasn't capable or competent, which would be perfectly reasonable reason for withdrawing his right to represent himself. I see nothing wrong first with allowing him to represent himself, nor subsequently withdrawing that when it becomes evident that he can't do it competently. Now, the thing that happened in Chicago was something else. It was an autocratic act by a man who has been described variously as a tyrant, and that's one of the nicer things that they say about Judge Hoffman. So what he did was perfectly in keeping with his conduct throughout the entire trial. Incidentally, This, I understand, I've never appeared before Judge Hoffman, and hopefully never have to, but it is said by lawyers who have appeared before him that this is no news to them, that in fact he has acted this way throughout his judicial history, and that he is always autocratic and tyrannical on the bench, that he frequently makes light and makes sarcastic remark towards defense counsel. It was only the fact that the eyes of the world were focused on that courtroom that so that his activities were allowed to be seen. What he did was just another piece of the fabric of a whole judicial scandal, and I think there's no other word to describe it, because what happened and what was allowed to happen in that court by the prosecution, as well as by the judge, the court itself, as well as by all of the other court functionaries, was a blot on the concept of justice in America. It's going to take a long time to erase, in fact, if it's in fact ever erased at all.
In a recent newspaper article, I believe it was in one of the Chicago papers, someone discussed the recent distribution of racist literature within the Chicago Police Department. Would you comment upon that?
I think you have reference to a policeman, black policeman, Renault Robinson, who is the president of the Afro-American Patrolmen's League, who made the statement jointly with Augustus Savage, who is a candidate, or at least who was yesterday, I don't know what the election results were this morning, for Congress in Chicago, in one of the congressional districts. The fact that the literature was passed through police channels was news. The fact that the literature was racist and was circulated within the precincts of the police department was not at all news. I've heard many instances of racist kinds of announcements being put on bulletin boards, and the racist nature of some and a great number of policemen in the Chicago Police Department is old hat. And immediately someone will say, how can you prove that? And I'll have to admit I can't, except by viewing circumstances that occur over and over and over again and the response of the police to them. That particular finding, that phenomenon of having shown that this literature was being circulated in official envelopes, interdepartmental envelopes, was just a happy and fortunate quirk that it was able to be shown that, in fact, they were being transported within the official mainstream of the police department memoranda. I don't know much else that I can say about that, except that I saw the thing myself, so I know it existed, despite the fact that they later said it didn't.
There have been recent discussions about the elite police force in Chicago, or the elite unit, which is probably analogous to New York's police or task force. And it was also discussed that the makeup of that group has been black and white, and recently there has been a decrease in the number of black members of that group. Would you please comment upon that if you know anything about it?
I'm not sure just which group you're talking about. There are several, I suppose, which could generally come under the definition. One would be the various task forces. That's elite in the sense that a policeman has to show that he is aggressive, that has to show that he's very active, that he has to make a certain number of arrests, a certain number of stops. Actually has a quota. This, too, will be denied by the Chicago Police Department, but happens to be true, and we have evidence of that. So that his days off, that is to say whether he's off on a weekend or in the middle of the week, how many days he's off, his promotions, the good assignments that he gets, all depend upon his activity. And the more active he is, the better policeman, evidently, he is judged to be, and the better kind of set he gets to work in. Then there are also other groups like the Gang Intelligence Unit, which is suddenly had its numbers increased from about 32 to over 200 about a year ago, and an alleged black officer put in charge of it, one who certain people say is incapable of making command decisions, but who rather is told what to do. I'm rather inclined to believe that myself. His name is Edward Buckney, now Captain Buckney, but who takes it upon himself to make public comments and write letters all over the country. I remember seeing a letter that he wrote to the Charles Kettering, well, the CKF, but that is a Charles Kettering Foundation, out in Denver after they'd given some money to a youth group in which he, first of all, maligned the director of the center that was to receive the money. He questioned the relevancy of the youth group. He warned the foundation that if they gave money to this particular group, it would cause bloodshed because another group would get angry and jealous of the money. And then he questioned the legitimacy of the motives of the foundation. Now, all this based on what is probably 2 cents worth of information. He certainly had no standing, certainly had no reason, and for some reason found it necessary in any event to inject himself into a financial dealing with people in Denver, Colorado. I've never been able to understand how he justified his activities. The fact that he did and the fact that they must have been received quite pleasantly by the ruling structure in Chicago, which is, say, the police department and the political system there, was that shortly thereafter he was promoted to captain. So I suppose he did it, at least with their blessing. But those kinds of tactics, the harassing of youths, the tactic of picking up a youth out of one neighborhood and dropping him off in another where he's likely to get himself hurt, the tactic of picking them up, planting contraband on their persons and arresting them for that, the practice of buying and getting informants and perjured testimony by threats in order to rip off the leadership of these youth groups is so widespread and so obvious that I suppose somebody who doesn't live there and who hasn't heard it before may think that I'm being rather insane to speak like this, but it happens to be a fact, and you know, it just happens every day.
To take you away from the criminal aspect for a second, and I'd like to get your general opinion on the recent fiasco in South Carolina, the busing and the desegregation bit. And I'd like to know whether you feel after 16 years, I myself was very young at the time that Brown was passed, but after roughly 16 or 17 years, do you feel that the judicial structure can adequately handle the problems of integration, or do you think they have really, in fact, failed as a practicing lawyer?
I think what it illustrates more than anything else is a phrase I've heard, and I don't even remember who said it first, but it was to the effect that there are no rights that a black man in this country has that any white man is obligated to respect. I think that's what it proves. I think that you can pass all the Browns you want. I think that you can put all the constitutional provisions you want. But as long as black people are a minority in this country, as long as they are viewed as either threats or something dirty by the largest numbers of whites in this country, I think that whatever is written down that we can understand and interpret as being beneficial to blacks can be subverted by the time it's applied. And I think Brown and the 17-year hiatus, which even now, even that slow movement is being curtailed, is just an illustration of that. But I don't think it's anything except another indication of the reluctance of this country to do more than to give lip service when it talks about the rights of all its citizens. And I think that under the current administration, we're even getting further and further away from any realization of equal rights for all the people of this country. So I wasn't at all surprised about these buses, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
You just mentioned this new administration. Along those lines, we have at this point the possibility of Mr. Carswell's appointment to the bench. And as a practical matter, we've got another potential vacancy on the bench as a result of the age of persons like Douglas. In view of that prospect, the prospect of having Carswell and the prospect of replacing Douglas with a Carswell, where do you see this country going legally? Do you see a reversal of Brown? Do you see a reversal of many of the other things?
Oh, yes. I think even at best, in the climate that exists today, people who have reason for dissent and who've been enjoying the privilege of dissent, or more accurately, the right of dissent, under the best of circumstances, they're going to find that the greater amounts of repression that are occurring today would increase. I think if added to that is the concept of mediocrity in our highest court, and incidentally, that I think is the kindest thing that could be said about Mr. Carswell. If the court becomes mediocre, as Congressman Hruska has said, you know, what did he say a couple of days ago? He said there are a lot of mediocre and not very bright lawyers and judges, and they have a right to representation on the Supreme Court too, something like that. So I see that as being a very dark day, but I don't think that's the death knell. I think the death knell has begun already, and that's just one of the bangs of the clapper as the thing goes back and forth. Too bad. I don't know where it will end, but yes, I see that. I'm frightened of that.
Last night you commented upon the Eighth Amendment right, the right to bail or freedom from excessive bail. And you made reference to many, well, poor people, but more specifically black people. And you termed this bail requirement a ransom requirement, a way to keep young black leadership in jail and keep them ineffective. I'd like to have you comment upon that. Plus, I'd like for you to also comment upon the fact of negotiated pleas relative to young blacks who are picked up on a nebulous charge, whatever, and, you know, because of the lack of funds and the bail routine and not being legally sophisticated, they acquiesce and, you know, they build a record. So if you ever do get them on something big, you know, if the allegations against them, their prior record would really, you know, just sort of push them on the guilty side.
Sure, I guess probably the most illustrative instance of what you're talking about, the last part of what you're talking about, was the April incidents, 1968, after Dr. King was killed, and something in excess of 3,000 black people were arrested in Chicago. The machinery for processing those people just broke down completely. They were not, the officials didn't even know where people were, so that even those who were able to make bail weren't able to find the place to pay the bail, and when the bail was paid, they couldn't find the defendants to get them out, so that at best people sat in jail 3 or 4 days, even when they had the money, simply because they couldn't be found. Now, if you've been picked up on a charge like disorderly conduct, which frequently is a $25 fine, or frequently a judge will say, how long has he been locked up? And it's been 1 day. He said, all right, we'll find him guilty and turn him loose. We consider the penalty being 1 day in jail, the day that he's already served. Those cases, just hundreds and hundreds of them as they came up, there would be a statement by the prosecutor that the man had been in jail 2, 3, 4 days, sometimes longer, 7, 10, 12, whatever. And the judge would at that time, if the defendant said that he'd plead guilty, he could go home. He wouldn't have to stand trial. This was conveyed to the defendants by the prosecution, and most of them were just too glad to be able to say anything and be allowed to walk out of that court without going back to the county jail to be locked up. And so, as a result, justice was completely averted, and what happened was that people, because of the expediency of getting out of custody, pleaded guilty. They were sentenced to however many days they had already spent waiting for trial, and then went home. The effect of that, statistically, of course, was to bolster the case of the law and order adherents in the city and say, there must be something to it. All these people were found guilty of these charges. Now, that happens in large mass so-called riot situations, but it also happens when you get a man who just doesn't have $25. He's arrested, and maybe he can get $25 for a week. His case comes up, and the same thing happens. It's a negotiated plea. He pleads guilty in order to get out, and it has nothing to do with a determination of the elements of the crime as applied to the act that he's accused of committing. Just doesn't have anything to do at all. The other thing that you're talking about is the large amounts of money. That's reserved more for those people that the society has decided are dangerous for one reason or another. And usually that danger is not a physical danger. It's the danger of propagating and communicating what they think are dangerous ideas. so that you find people like the New York 21, well, they're not quite 21, but that's what they're called, who've been in jail for 10 months because of an inability to raise the kind of ransom that's being required there. With the same circumstance in Chicago, where we've had people locked up for long periods of time, bond up to $100,000, and then reduced, I would hope, jokingly, by the Supreme Court to $75,000, still, money which is still too far. So that's what I refer to as ransom, that is to say, holding people in jail for long periods of time prior to finding them guilty on the charges. They're not supposed to do that either.
Isn't there a different, another type of lockup, and that is the power of a state's attorney's office, a court to keep a person within state boundaries and thereby preventing them from doing what, from exercising their right of dissent?
Yes, there's an illustration of that would be your own state's attorney, Mr. Larry Johnson, right here in Champaign County, who makes it his business to see that Bobby Rush, who is the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, he tries to see that Bobby isn't allowed to go outside the boundaries of Illinois. Now, the reason that he would have to travel, of course, is to raise money. He speaks and gets paid for it. And that's the only income, incidentally, that he has. So Mr. Johnson and his assistants have been quite energetic in opposing all such actions on the part of Bobby Rush. I've not been able to understand why. I guess there isn't much to do here in Champaign County as far as the law and order syndrome is concerned. So if it keeps Mr. Johnson busy, well, I'm for it too, I guess. Although it gives me some problems.
Would you comment on the trial of Rap Brown and what may be the outcome of that in view of the conspiracy trial?
Anything that I would say would just be complete speculation and therefore worthless. I think the most interesting thing about that whole situation is not the trial so much as the obvious high feeling running about it on an incident that occurred years ago. You know, people up until this trial began had really kind of forgotten who Rap Brown was. And now suddenly getting death threats and bombings and things. And that's interesting. I don't know why, and if you find out, I'd appreciate if you let me know. I thought he had kind of faded from sight. Since we've got about 30, 40 seconds left, I'd just like to say to both Doris and David, as law students, that when you come out and begin to practice law, what I really hope you do is not to fall prey to the siren lure of Wall Street, LaSalle Street, or whatever street happens to be the place that you settle in, but that you make the tool and the skill that you're going to get here at law school some kind of service to the people of this country and be more concerned about helping it get itself together. I think that's probably the most important thing you can do as lawyers. I certainly hope you do it.
We'd like to thank Mr. Coleman and Miss Whalum and Mr. Addison for being with us today. You've been listening to A Conversation with Kermit Coleman. He's an attorney, director of the Illinois Ghetto Project with headquarters in Chicago, and also a member of the Roger Baldwin Foundation of the American Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Coleman spoke on the University of Illinois Urbana campus on Tuesday evening, March 17th, and joined us in our studios the following morning for the conversation. Heard with Mr. Coleman were Miss Doris Whalum and Mr. David.